This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Andy Herber, a physician assistant in hospital medicine at Mayo Clinic's Rochester campus. Potassium disorders are quite commonly encountered by primary care providers. High and low potassium, if not appropriately managed, can lead to lethal complications. Today, we will be discussing management of hyper and hypokalemia. Today, we're joined by Dr. Mira Kettis, a Mayo Clinic nephrologist, associate professor of medicine, and highly decorated educator. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kettis.
It's a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you so much for inviting me back.
You bet. So today's topic, potassium. I think we should probably start with hyperkalemia. So what can you tell us about hyperkalemia?
I have to start by saying I enjoy talking about potassium. It's something that I get to teach our learners at different levels. And it's dear and near to my heart because I tell my trainees that if there's an electrolyte you're going to get called about in the hospital service, it's probably going to be a high potassium or a low sodium. So it's something that we see commonly in the inpatient setting. And as you alluded to, Andrew, it's a big deal because it really is the most common lethal electrolyte abnormality in the hospital setting when you think of all the different electrolytes that can go awry. So it's really important to understand it, respect it, and feel empowered to be able to manage it. Now, you asked me about high potassium. So potassium in general, why should we care? So just to reorient you a little bit, potassium is mainly inside the cells, not outside. So when you start seeing changes in potassium from in the blood draw, so plasma potassium being elevated, you should always realize that you're dealing with a lot of potassium in the body, because what's happening in the blood compartment is actually a very, very small amount of the potassium that your entire body will have, because the bulk of potassium is inside cells, not outside cells. And any changes in potassium, high or low, will actually lead to cardiac conduction defects. And I can't tell you how many times I've been called with patients who have bradycardia or lethal arrhythmias. And really the key was either dialyze them right away or bring that potassium down. So it's something that can definitely cause imminent harm to the patient, but we can also do a lot of good to try to turn it around. And there are other things that potassium alterations can cause as well, including muscle weakness. And actually, low potassium can contribute to things like high blood pressure or insulin sensitivity, among other things. But I really want you to think about cardiac conduction problems as the main complication of too high or too low of potassium.
So when we think about causes, outpatient setting of potassium, obviously drugs are one of them. And the slam dunk is a potassium sparing diuretic obviously is going to cause potassium to stay elevated. But on our outpatient patient panel, are there other drugs that you tend to see that are causing potassium to be elevated?
Yeah, great question. It's always a nuisance when you're checking blood tests and potassium is up and it's not straightforward. You're like, oh, what was it? Why is your potassium up? And I do get those cases every now and then. It kind of makes me think a few times too. As you mentioned, the potassium sparing diuretics, and just to spell out what these would be. So anything that blocks your aldosterone path or acts in the part of the kidney where aldosterone normally would work. So things like triamterene, which we don't often use as a diuretic by itself. It usually comes as a combination with something else. But triamterene, spironolactone, eplerenone, the new drug on the block, finerenone, all these medications will raise potassium. Amiloride is another old school one to be aware of. So these are all considered potassium sparing. All other diuretics other than the ones I listed will give you low potassium. And so it's important to distinguish between the two. The other class of medications that we use all the time, especially for our patients with high blood pressure or diabetes, are going to be a RAS inhibitor. So whether it be the angiotensin receptor blockers like losartan or your ACE inhibitors like lisinopril, for example. Now, believe it or not, probably mentioned in another podcast, but nephrologists don't like NSAIDs. And one of those reasons we don't like NSAIDs is because they can also promote high potassium. And that may not be apparent if that's not listed as a prescription medication. So if you're dealing with a high potassium and you just can't figure out where it's coming from, it'd be worth finding out if they're taking over-the-counter NSAIDs on a regular basis. Now, I should also mention that there are some antibiotics that can actually precipitate or contribute to high potassium. I'm sure you all are aware of that, but just to remind you, so the trimethoprim part of Bactrim can contribute to high potassium. And the same thing even with pentamidine. Ketoconazole can also do that, and it does that because it inhibits aldosterone. And in our transplant population or some of our immunocompromised patients, calcineurin inhibitors, so things like tacrolimus or cyclosporin, can also increase potassium.
Great. So as far as diet, bananas always get a bad rap. Hey, if your potassium's high or low, you know, that's going to impact how many bananas you should eat. Is there other dietary concerns people, you know, if you see a mild hyperkalemia, are you telling patients you should stop eating this?
Yeah, great question. Maybe I'll answer it in two parts. One part would be a healthy individual with a good working kidney and really no risk factors for high potassium. They can eat all the bananas they want. And bananas should not make them hyperkalemic. So it takes, I would say, more than one hit. It takes more than diet alone for potassium alterations to occur. And so I wouldn't worry about too many bananas in someone who has an adequate kidney function, who's not on any medications that can promote high potassium, for example. So that's one point. The other point is we do give bananas a bad rep, unfortunately, by kind of blaming them on being the high potassium food. But believe it or not, there's a lot of potassium in strawberries and watermelon, avocados. One of my mentors, Dr. McCarthy, who's since retired, he once taught me that anything that's red, orange, or yellow is going to have a lot of potassium in it. So that kind of unfortunately lists a lot of fruits. A lot of fruit has potassium, peaches, strawberries, melons, tomatoes, oranges. So if you think of those color pattern, you'll probably end up putting a lot of things under that category of high potassium food.
Most providers listening to this podcast certainly have a wide array of disease states on their panel. I feel like diabetics are a little bit more prone to hyperkalemia. Is there a reason behind that?
Yeah, it's absolutely correct. And the simple answer is there is a tendency for diabetic patients to be more resistant to the effect of aldosterone in their kidneys. In order for your kidney to effectively get rid of potassium, and just to back up here, with all due respect to everything that the gut does, the kidney is really the primary organ that handles all the potassium in your system. So if you were to eat 100 millimoles of potassium, 90% of that is peed out. And the gut is only taking care of about 10%. So good kidney function and the part of the kidney that handles the potassium excretion is affected in diabetics, even if they have normal kidney function or very little decline in their GFR. And that's because they do have that resistance to the effect of aldosterone in that part of the kidney. It's particularly called the principal cell. And it makes it harder for the kidney to pee out that potassium. So you may notice that diabetics are more prone to hyperkalemia, and sometimes it makes it very challenging to give them those effective medications like finerenone or ACE inhibitors, and you may have to be creative with the right cocktail of medications to balance the potassium out.
As you've mentioned and talked about, so diabetes puts you at risk, kidney disease will put you at risk, some of the medications you listed will put you at risk. So if the patient comes in and they get their standard blood work and their potassium comes back at 5.5, I know it's not a one size fits all, but what would kind of be a standard approach to managing mild hyperkalemia?
Yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning that it's not one size fits all, so you have to think about your context. I can give you maybe an example. I've had I got a call for a curbside about a healthy outpatient who's been doing well for a while. They are on an ACE inhibitor, but other than that, you know, great kidney function, no other risk factors, never had a high potassium problem. And then they had a blood drawn, the potassium was about 5.5, and I got a call. It's like, hey, what should I do? Should I really stress out about that? And I said, well, it seems like an outlier. Yeah, they are an ACE inhibitor. They have perfect kidney function. Why don't you recheck it? Okay. Because there is this concept of pseudo hyperkalemia. What does that mean? Is that when your potassium is high in the test tube, not in your blood? And that can happen from a variety of reasons. If the tourniquet is too tight, if you're clenched your fist too much, if the sample sat out for a little while, if the temperature is cold, like in Minnesota, there are a lot of other things that can actually influence the potassium leaking in the test tube that can give you artificial elevation in potassium, and you don't want to react to that. So this is the outlier context where you have a fluke high potassium, you know, not typical for that patient. What would you do? Just take it easy and repeat it. Maybe when you tell them, when you repeat it, don't clench your fist too tight. Tell them not make the tourniquet too much. Sometimes you ask the patient, was this a tough blood draw? And sometimes, oh yeah, it was a very hard blood draw. And that gives me a little bit of a context of this, is this an accurate value or not? On the other side though, if you've got your diabetic patient or even a patient with kidney disease and they have a potassium of 5.5 and they tend to run, you know, average to high normal, you have to be very careful about not overreacting to a potassium, especially when it's not reaching that level of concern. And level of concern is around 6. You have to be careful not to change medications that would remove the beneficial effect. So the standard approach would be, if you've got someone who tends to run high potassium, instead of cutting back on their RAS inhibitors or removing a cardioprotective medication like finerenone, for example, why don't you add a binding resin? Why don't you give them something else that will help them get rid of potassium? Why don't you guide them or direct them to eat a lower potassium diet and see if that levels it off? There's no harm in living at the 5.1 at the high limit of normal of potassium if you're on all the right protective medications.
Okay. You brought it up, but it sounds like 6 is kind of where piques your interest a little bit more. Is that where you're kind of checking your EKG to see how much urgency this has? Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this one can sometimes be challenging when you've got a potassium of 6 and it's a clinic patient. You're thinking, boy, do I admit them? Did I manage this outpatient? And again, a lot of it depends on the context and the patient and their cardiovascular health. So in general, what our literature suggests is that if your potassium is over 6, really that should be your threshold, getting an ECG and making sure that you're not seeing signs of high potassium effect. You know, you probably remember the peak T wave, prolonged PR, the dreaded sine wave. And we don't always see that. So the truth is only about 50% of people will have an ECG abnormality with a potassium greater than 6, but it must be checked. And again, think about the context of your patient and what cardiovascular disease they have. They may be on other medications that affect their electrolytes. They may have AFib. You don't want to trigger an event. And so put everything in context and think about your patient's cardiovascular health to guide how aggressive you are with your potassium management. So a high above 6, you do an ECG and you got to have a plan to figure out how you're going to get rid of that potassium. The other group of patients I want you to be mindful of, and we typically see those more in the hospital setting, not in the clinic, is that when you're getting called or maybe you're taking care of a patient who's sick, we're talking in an ICU setting, most likely, or maybe a neuro floor with a new neuromuscular weakness, someone who's in evolving shock, for example, sepsis that's heading south, acute MI, or someone who just had a cardiopulmonary arrest. These are patients who are in flux. And as I mentioned, all these potential disease settings, these are cases where there may be muscle breakdown, there may be cell death, hypoxic injury. Anytime you're dealing with those type of clinical situations, cells are not happy. And remember, potassium is abundant inside the cell. So you can imagine those patients may start leaking potassium a lot more than someone who doesn't have an active illness that would promote cell death. So if your potassium goes up by more than 1 point, and typical units will be milliequivalents per liter. So let's say the beginning of the day when you do your 4 or 5 a.m. labs, the potassium is 4.5. These are sick patients. You're doing another set of labs. And so by the afternoon, the potassium is 5.6. So it went up by over 1 point. So from 4.5 to 5.6. 5.6 may not get you too excited, but in that clinical context, you actually better get your A game on and be ready to bring that potassium down. So if it's more than 6, you get a work on it, you get an EKG, work on it. If you have a sick individual, and you're seeing that increase by more than one above that 4.5, get your toolkit ready. So what is that toolkit? That's probably what we need to talk about. How are you going to manage that? And there are a lot of protocols out there, and I think they're very helpful. I do want to caution you about using those hyperkalemia protocols for patients with kidney failure or on dialysis, because they're not as effective. But in general, what you want to do is you got to stabilize the heart, right? If you've got an ECG abnormality, then this patient needs some calcium, whether it be calcium, typically it's calcium chloride or calcium gluconate. Giving calcium to a patient just for awareness does absolutely nothing to your potassium balance. The only thing calcium is doing is supporting your heart temporarily. This is not forever treatment until you bring that potassium down. Now, the second thing that you work with is shifting. What do I mean by that? Remember how I said the cells have tons of potassium in them? Well, you could do a lot of different things to move potassium back into the cell and outside of your plasma compartment. And we do that all the time. Albuterol moves it inside the cell. Sodium bicarb moves it inside the cell. Insulin and glucose, it moves it inside the cell. So these are all shifting medications, and they would be warranted in those cases where you've got the potassium more than 6, or you've got that increase by more than 1 above 4.5. Now, it's very critical, and something that I often see missed sometimes, is that when you initiate those shifting treatments, you have to think about the fact that their effect is temporary. And what you're doing is you're moving potassium around. You're not actually getting rid of potassium. So you have to think of working with shifting plus elimination. You cannot have one without the other, meaning that shift, because shifting things will move potassium a lot faster. But while you're doing all that, go ahead and start thinking about, okay, what does this patient need? Are they dry? Maybe we give them some fluids that are not high in potassium. Maybe they're wet. Maybe I should go ahead and give them some diuretic. Obviously, you're going to pick a diuretic that's not potassium sparing, so something like a loop diuretic, for example. Or perhaps you're going to start adding a binding resin. And we have so many options now, so things like Lokelma or Pteramir or even good old K-Exalate. So just remember that when you're dealing with potassium emergency, when your potassium is more than 6, or your potassium goes up by more than 1 milliequivalents per liter above 4.5, get your shifting toolkit ready and work on elimination. If you have a patient who does not fill those clinical situations of what we would call emergency, let's say the potassium is not above 6, then you don't need to rush into shifting. You don't need to have that sense of urgency to bring it down, and just focus on elimination only.
Awesome. That was super helpful. So the outpatient that has a potassium of 5.7 and the EKG looks fine, doesn't need to go to the hospital, but we want to do something about that potassium. What would your recommendation be for that patient?
I typically go with reviewing their medications, anything on that medication list that promoted the high potassium. If yes, I have them hold it temporarily. We talk about diet. Hey, was there a dietary factor that contributed to this unusually high potassium? Work on your diet. And then I really rely heavily on loop diuretics. They work really, really well at potassium elimination, especially in someone who's euvolemic or hypervolemic. If somebody comes in really dry, that may not work very well. But if they're outpatient, you know they're not dry, they're normal, or maybe on the edematous side, the loop diuretic will work all the time. Now, potassium is kind of like treating hypertensive emergency or urgency. You treat it, you bring them back, you recheck, you see if you've achieved your goal. So eat less potassium, hold off on your ACE inhibitor for a few days, take a dose of Lasix, here's a prescription for the next 2-3 days, and I'm going to recheck your potassium again in 3 days and see what's going on. So that you can stabilize things without sending them to the hospital. But ultimately, you really need to figure out what triggered it, right? What caused that, so that you can figure out a treatment plan that keeps them safe and protect them from having this happening again.
Is there any situation where you would not prescribe a potassium resin in the outpatient setting?
Really, the bucket of patients that I don't typically use binding resin for would be patients who've had maybe short gut or resections, abdominal resections, if they have underlying GI surgeries, I tend to avoid using binding resins. It's important to know that loop diuretics work really well, but I think that would be a really good option for patients, for example, who may be on the hypovolemic side, or they tend to get more dry, or maybe very prone to dehydration, or their blood pressure already tends to run low. I think a binding resin would be an excellent idea.
Is it myth or fact? So you give somebody a binding resin, do they have to have a bowel movement to have the impact of the potassium loss, or does that work? Because I feel like that's always a question. Well, I shouldn't recheck my potassium yet because I haven't had a bowel movement.
You know, that's the old school dogma when the only binding resin we had was K-Exalate. But now that we have two other drugs on the market, FDA approved, well-studied, in fact, some of their side effects is constipation, not diarrhea. And so that really, that association with diarrhea is really unique to K-Exalate.
Okay. So in theory, like one dose as an outpatient or one or two doses, and then you could recheck them, bowel movement or not.
Right. Okay. You're absolutely right. I am biased towards diuretics because you have to also understand the context of my patient population where all of them have impaired kidney function. So for me, a loop diuretic does more than one thing. It helps with edema, helps blood pressure, can help with potassium. But if you've got an intact kidney function where the driver for the high potassium is maybe, you know, drugs, for example, I think a binding resin is a fine idea.
Well, thanks for talking to us about hyperkalemia. So what about hypokalemia? What are some causes of hypokalemia? I mean, I remember vomiting and diarrhea, but are there some other causes out there that are quite frequent on our outpatient population?
Yeah, but hypokalemia is not as complicated, but you can think of it in three buckets. Maybe there is something that caused shifting of too much potassium shifting inside the cell. So that's a possibility. You can get that with a thyroid storm, for example. Thyroid hormone can promote more potassium going inside the cell, for example. The other thing to think about will be anything that affects aldosterone. So whether you have an aldosterone-like hormone, for example, cortisol, people who may have underlying Cushing's or hypercortisolism, or patients who may have hyperaldosteronism. So these are two hormones that will promote potassium loss from the kidney. So you're right, it's either gut or kidney. So you're either losing it from the gut or you're losing it from the kidney. If it's from the gut, diarrhea is a concern, vomiting, both of those can contribute to low potassium. And then if you're losing it primarily from the kidney, then you're thinking it's a hormone that's promoting more potassium loss in the kidney, typically aldosterone, but cortisol can do a similar thing, or it could be an underlying genetic process. Back in the olden days of medical school, you may have heard about Barters or Gittleman's. They're both relatively rare diseases, but both of them will give you potassium loss in the urine. And then diuretics. Don't forget, diuretics are a double-edged sword. You know, thiazides or loops, they can definitely drop your potassium level quite low. So again, you kind of think about your medications.
Outside of diuretics off the top of your head, are there any other sneaky meds that can cause hypokalemia?
Yeah, believe it or not, some antibiotics can do that. And it has to do with when you give an antibiotic in the penicillin type class, there's anion, an associated anion that has to be excreted and that gets filtered through the kidney. And anytime you generate an anion from a medication or toxic exposure, that anion we don't pee sparks. So if there's an anion, there needs to be a cation in order to be removed, right? And so the cation that's most abundant is potassium. So it kind of becomes a sacrificial lamb here. And any excess of anion in the urine will trap potassium. And then you end up peeing out more potassium than you planned on. So antibiotics can contribute to hypokalemia as well. And just for the nephrologist out there, in case they're listening, vomiting, you don't vomit potassium, actually. So there's not a lot of potassium in the vomit content or, you know, gastric contents. You actually get hypokalemia from renal loss of potassium when you're vomiting. So truly the true gut-related cause of low potassium would be diarrhea. You truly do lose a lot of potassium in the stool, but you don't have potassium in a gastric content. That may be a nice question to ask around on rounds for fun fact.
when we were talking about hyperkalemia, kind of the threshold was that 6, where you were like, okay, now we should probably get an EKG. Is there kind of on the inverse side there? Is there a threshold for hypokalemia where you're like, we should probably check an EKG, or we should do something a little bit more urgent?
I would say for hypokalemia, again, think about the clinical context. If you have somebody who's prone to arrhythmia, I'd probably check an EKG a little sooner. And if not, then you may wait on it a little bit. So what's my threshold will be around 3. So if you're 3 or low, you probably should get an ECG. But if you've got somebody with underlying arrhythmia, you may need an ECG at 3.2 to see how things are going. And obviously you worry about prolonged QT and other things to realize as I didn't mention it, but low magnesium can promote low potassium. So you may find hypokalemia and, you know, it's not a gut issue, it's not a kidney issue, and you're kind of confused where that could be from. So remember to check a certain magnesium level.
And is it true that you need to replace magnesium first before you replace potassium? Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It really has to do with the way magnesium affects potassium at the level of the kidney. So when you don't have enough magnesium, you end up peeing out too much potassium, believe it or not. So whatever you give them, they're going to pee it out. So you have to fix the magnesium problem so that faucet can slow down a little bit and that you're not losing all that potassium supplements that you're giving in the urine.
It's been a long, long time since I've been in school, but I feel like in school, the teaching was for every 10th of a milliequivalent you were low, you would give 10 milliequivalents of potassium. Is that kind of still the rule of thumb? As far as replacing potassium?
Still the rule. Absolutely, Andrew. So it seems like everything in medicine has changed, but this one hasn't.
And then is there a certain tab? There's so many options for potassium tabs. There's slow release. There's potassium with phosphorus, potassium. Is there one that you should give versus the other? Or should you just say, you know, stop at the grocery store and grab some bananas and sweet potatoes? Or is there kind of a strategy behind this replacement?
As you know, and many of you all know, potassium chloride is a really big tablet. And a lot of patients may struggle with it, whether it be the size or just being able to swallow it. Thankfully, there are other ways to give potassium, whether it be dissolvable or liquid form, and maybe a little bit harder to get, but that would be another option to get around it. So I think it's, if you're doing this in the outpatient setting, it's good to have that disclaimer with your patients. It's a big pill, and you know, are you comfortable swallowing big pills? And if that's the case, then potassium chloride is good to go. Or if not, you may want to consider the liquid form. Now, differentiating potassium chloride from potassium citrate, from potassium phosphate, it really depends what else you're treating. Right? So potassium chloride, all that's going to do is change your potassium. It's not going to do anything else. There are potassium citrates, so I use that all the time for my kidney stone patients. But if you're doing that, you are changing two things. You're changing potassium, but you're also changing your bicarbonate. The citrate is going to be converted to bicarbonate. So if you don't need to do that, then you probably shouldn't use potassium citrate, should potassium chloride. And then potassium phosphate, I don't recommend that unless somebody is dealing with a low phosphorus level, because then otherwise you'll be giving them an excess of phosphorus that they may not need. So it really depends on what the other concomitant electrolyte that you may be trying to fix or address. In the hospital setting, as you're aware, we cannot give potassium very fast. And so you kind of do need to rely on an oral route in addition to IV, for example, if they have a really low level, to be able to get enough replacement. Because you can imagine, right? We just talked about the 1-to-10 ratio. If somebody comes in with a potassium of 3, then I need to give them 100 milliequivalents of potassium. And that may be very hard to do orally because it's a lot. You may need to kind of figure out a rhythm of some oral. Ideally, you want to distribute that over time, not one big dose at a time. That would not be well tolerated. And then some that you would give IV.
Fantastic. So if you had to give kind of just a summary to an outpatient provider who gets a mild elevation in potassium, so 2 minutes on that, how would you kind of remind them to manage a potassium of 5.7?
Yeah, number one, verify. I think that would be the reasonable approach, especially if it's somebody you didn't expect them to have high potassium. Number two, review their medications, both prescription and non-prescription. Number three, go ahead and consider binding resin or a loop diuretic, depending on what their volume status looks like, and then recheck.
Okay, Dr. Kettis, so we have a patient that comes in and their primary care provider checks their electrolytes, and lo and behold, their potassium is 3.1. How should they manage that?
First things first is, how did this happen? Are you having any diarrhea? Did I start you on a diuretic recently and just forgot to give you potassium supplements? Because, you know, and that's why you ended up with the low potassium. So you can quickly kind of think through it. Is there a GI loss or is this a renal loss? And then react to that. Number two, if they are an elderly individual, they have underlying cardiovascular disease, you may want to do an ECG. Well, why would you want to do an ECG? Well, if they have prolonged QT, for example, it's somebody that may need to be admitted, or maybe somebody that you need to send to an infusion center for some IV potassium plus oral replacement. So your ECG gives you a little bit of a pulse check of the urgency of replacement. But in general, let's say they don't have cardiovascular disease, there's ECG, there's no reason to get an ECG, or the ECG is normal, then you tell them about all the amazing food choices that are high in potassium, and then you go ahead and give them a supplemental plan. Now, we tend to try to supplement to keep it close to 4 if somebody has underlying arrhythmia, but you don't need to aim towards 4. You can try to aim for 3.5 or 3.8. just enough to get them out of that danger zone. And that's very doable with oral replacement. And don't forget to recheck. So that's another very important point. Don't give too much potassium without having a plan to know what caused it and what their long-term treatment plan will look like in the same if you're dealing with high potassium.
Fantastic. We've been talking about potassium imbalances with Dr. Mira Kettis. Thank you for your time, Dr. Kettis. If you have enjoyed Mayo Clinic's Talks podcast, please follow us for weekly content. Thank you for your attention today. And as President Teddy Roosevelt once said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. This is Andy Herber from Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Have a great day.